Hello and welcome to the Backtracker History Show podcast with me, Alice. Join me as we go on a gentle stroll through the archives to discover intriguing tales about people and events that happened in the past. Each episode is a podcast-friendly version of a show that's been aired on Bradleystoke Radio in Bristol, England, all of which will be brought to life by an array of amazing voice talent from across the world. We have stories about a huge variety of subjects, from activists to war heroes. We've got it all. So get ready for the latest installment of the Backtracker History Show, bringing the past back to life. The event we'll be talking about today occurred in the year 1963, and as always, we look and see what else happened that year. Well, on May the 1st, the Coca-Cola Company introduces the first diet drink, and they called it Tab Cola. On the 3rd of June, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam rains liquid chemicals on the heads of Buddhist protesters, injuring 67 people. The United States threatens to cut off aid to the regime of Nguyen Dinh Diem. The South Vietnamese politician who was the final prime minister of the state of Vietnam and later the first president of South Vietnam from 1955 until his capture and assassination during the CIA-backed 1963 South Vietnamese coup. The 20th of June sees the premiere of the war film The Great Escape, starring Steve McQueen and Richard Attenborough, in London. On the 8th of August 1963, we see the Great Train Robbery taking place in Buckinghamshire in England. In total, £2.61 million were stolen from a Royal Mail train heading from Glasgow to London on the West Coast Main Line. August the 28th, and Martin Luther King Jr. delivers his I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial to an audience of at least 250,000 during the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. It is at that point the single largest protest in American history. And the biggest event that occurred this year was on the 22nd of November, when John F. Kennedy was assassinated in a motorcade in Dallas, Texas, fatally shot by Lee Harvey Oswald. Lastly, on December the 20th, we saw the Frankfurt-Auschwitz trials begin. This was a series of trials running from the 20th of December to the 19th of August 1965, charging 22 defendants under German criminal law for their roles in the Holocaust as mid to lower level officials in the Auschwitz-Birkenau death and concentration camp complex. Overall, though, only 789 individuals of the approximately 8,200 surviving SS personnel who served in Auschwitz and its subcamps were ever tried, of whom only 750 received sentences. But the event we'll be talking about today occurred on the 17th of December 1963, when Russell Pascoe, aged 23, paid the ultimate price for his part in the murder of reclusive farmer William Garfield Rowe, believing he had a large sum of money hidden on his farm, Nanjaro Farm, in Constantine, near Falmouth. Russell Pascoe, aged 23, met his fate at Horfield Prison in Bristol, whilst his accomplice, Dennis Whitty, aged 22, was simultaneously executed at Winchester Prison. Their crime was a senseless murder. They killed reclusive farmer William Rowe, believing he had a large sum of money hidden in his house, However, they left with only £4 and a watch. The victim, William Rowe, had been a bit of a recluse. In 1917, he had been a deserter from the army and had hidden on his parents' farm from 1917 until 1953, when, as part of the coronation celebrations, the Queen gave an amnesty to all deserters. Only then did Rowe begin to show himself during the day around the farm, and by the 1960s he was living on the farm on his own, after the deaths of his mother and brother. In 1963, Pascoe and Whitty lived with three women at Kenwyncarron Park in Cornwall. Whitty worked as a labourer at Truro Gasworks, while Pascoe had previously worked at Nanjaro Farm. And the labourer discovered the old man didn't bank his money, and there was cash in the drawers, tin boxes and loose on windowsills and tables. And so, when money was running short in the caravan, that's when Pascoe told Whitty where he thought they could get some easy cash. And so, on the night of Wednesday, the 14th of August, 1963, Whitty and Pascoe travelled to Nanjaro Farm on Whitty's motorcycle. They were armed with a starting pistol, a knife and an iron bar. Whitty was wearing dark jeans and a dark double-breasted blazer with silver buttons. They got to the house at about 11 p.m. and Rowe was attacked by Pascoe and Whitty when they used a fake helicopter crash story to gain access. The pair rushed into the house, Pascoe hitting him on the head with an iron bar. The elderly man struggled with his attackers, and as Pascoe would later say,
"To my surprise, Whitty pulled out a knife and stabbed him."
The attack resulted in Rowe's death with multiple wounds, including a severed finger, fractured skull, broken jaw and five chest wounds, including one knife wound to the heart. The pair searched the house for money, but came away with only £4 and a watch. The sum of £3,000 was later found in the farmhouse by police.
Word of the week.
This week, the word I give you is serendipity, which is the act of finding something valuable or interesting when you're not looking for it. And this was coined by English author Horace Walpole in the mid-1700s, crediting it to a fairy tale he read called The Three Princes of Serendip. In the tale, three Persian princes sailed to an island called Serendip, which is known today as Sri Lanka, to find their fortunes, making wondrous discoveries along the way. On the day of the execution outside Horfield Prison, around 60 protesters gathered, showing respect for the murder victim, William Rowe. Organised by the Bristol Committee for the Abolition of Capital Punishment, the vigil lasted 64 hours, enduring the December chill around a brazier. And even though it was small, the group had influential backers, including Oliver Tomkins, the Bishop of Bristol, and local MP Anthony Wedgwood Benn, who predicted this would be Bristol's last hanging. Indeed, Pascoe became the 14th and final man hanged at HMS Prison, Bristol, laid to rest in an unmarked grave within the prison grounds. Historically, Bristol saw hundreds of public executions until 1849, when they were conducted within the walls of the new jail on Cumberland Road, and later at Horfield from 1883. In the 20th century, nearly 800 civilians, mostly men, faced the gallows across Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Legal reform significantly reduced these numbers, with Horfield becoming a preferred regional venue for hangings due to its dedicated condemned block. The Reverend F.C. Vivian Jones, Vicar of St. Michael's in Bristol, wrote to the Home Secretary asking for mercy for Pascoe and Whitty, saying that no human being has the right to take the life of another, even in retaliation. Bob Douglas was a young Scottish prison officer from Birmingham Prison who sat with Pascoe in the weeks before his execution. And he talked about his prisoner's final days as he was hoping for a reprieve. And whilst Bob was in Bristol, he was going to be staying with a local family. The night shift started at 10 p.m. and for the duration of this particular assignment, he was teamed up with an ex-Royal Marine called Ken from Exeter Prison. On the other two shifts were four officers from various prisons. There always had to be two officers on duty with a condemned man around the clock. When he was interviewed in the 80s, Bob said,
"On that Sunday night, Ken and I went in to meet Russell Pascoe and to see where we would spend a big part of the next 6 weeks on CC duty. You had no days off, you changed every week from night shift to afternoon shift, 2 p.m. to 10 p.m, and then the shorter day shift, 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. Pascoe was a stockily built, curly-haired young man of 22. He would spend his 23rd birthday in the condemned cell." Word on the street.
Now, this is one I found interesting. We're going to Hareclive Road in BS 13 in Bristol. This was the Saxon name for Hartcliffe, with Hare meaning army in Old English, and Clive a steep, rugged cliff or rock face. Many battles were believed to have been fought in this area. The original date for the execution was November the 19th. Condemned men were always allowed 3 clear Sundays to make their peace with God. But this was cancelled for an appeal to be heard, and during the 3-week wait, Pascoe and his guards settled into a routine. The cell was about 25 feet long and 12 feet wide. At one end was Pascoe's bed and a bedside cabinet with a lamp. And at the other end was a table and 3 reasonably comfortable easy chairs. On the table was a lamp which at night the guards would half cover with a green cloth so that they could read while Pascoe slept at the far end of the cell. At the end of the room, opposite the bed, was a door to the bathroom and another to the toilet. When Pascoe was in the bathroom and toilet, the guards had to be with him, and the only sharp object he was allowed was a locking safety razor. All clothing had no buttons, only ties, and the prisoner didn't have a belt or necktie. In the middle of the room was a locked door which led across a narrow corridor to another door, behind which was the execution chamber. In the condemned cell, you had a radio and games like Monopoly and Scrabble, playing cards as well as library books. So the two guards played games with Pascoe until he got bored. Pascoe would be visited every day from either the governor, deputy governor, medical officer, or the prison chaplain, a rather eccentric old ex-Royal Navy padre who painstakingly tried to teach Pascoe to play bezique, a complicated game which he never really mastered. In his interview, Bob Douglas talks about taking Pascoe to London and finding out some dreadful but historic news.
"On Friday, November 22nd, it was time to take Pascoe to London for his appeal to be heard at the Old Bailey. As Ken and I were on day shift, we took him by car to Pentonville, where we were lodged in this early Victorian prison's small, dark and gloomy condemned cell. It was a place where such infamous murderers as Crippen, Haig and Christie had spent their last weeks. Ken and I lodged with Pentonville officers, and we had a night out in London. On returning to our digs, we were met with the news that President Kennedy had been assassinated.
Pascoe was allowed to have an hour's exercise every day, but he seldom took the full hour. 30 minutes or less would be enough for him. Pascoe's appeal was denied, So all that was left for him to do was to petition the Home Secretary, Henry Brooke, who had the power to commute his sentence to life imprisonment. If that failed, the last resort was to appeal to the Queen herself for clemency. And so a new date for his execution was now the 17th of December, and a petition was drafted and sent to the Home Secretary. Haskell's spirits rose again. There was still hope. And so as they settled into another long wait, life returned to the usual routine. During his wait to hear back about his appeal, Pascoe talked a bit about his case and his victim, William Rowe. On Saturday, December the 14th, the governor came in and handed Pascoe an official letter and at the same time informed him of its contents. Pascoe's petition to the Home Secretary had been denied. On hearing this, Pascoe replied,
"Thanks,"
and immediately went to lie on his bed at the far end of the cell. Only the Queen could save him now. And that never happened. The day before Pascoe's death, a leader column in the Bristol Evening Post said that the vigil at Horfield had
reminded people of a dark corner of our law, which by its illogical, clumsy definition and its bitter clinging to revenge, rather than reform as an essential quality of justice, is an intolerable anachronism.
During the night shifts, things were almost normal, but at times Pascoe was really down with no real interest in listening to the radio or playing cards. When Bob arrived at work on the Monday at around 9 p.m, he had to pass through the anti-hanging protesters who were outside the prison demonstrating against the Christmas hangings, as they were being called. Hangman Harry Allen and his assistant had arrived that afternoon to dodge the demonstrators and were spending the night in the prison. Allen's deputy and his assistant were at Winchester. Whitty, the partner in the crime, was to be hanged at exactly the same time. Harry Allen, the hangman, was a Manchester publican and a real character by all accounts. For many years, he was chief assistant to Britain's most famous hangman, Albert Pierpoint. Together, they had hanged not only murderers in the UK, but also in far-flung parts of the Empire. Allen had already been with the governor to visit Pascoe in the cell. He didn't say who he was, he just stuck his hand out and said,
"Hello, son."
Pascoe had automatically taken his hand and shook it. Before going in for the last night shift, the chief officer called Bob and Ken, the two guards, into his office and said,
"He's very down. He was told this afternoon the Queen has denied him clemency."
And so that night, conversation with Pascoe was hard, until he said,
"Who was that who came in with the governor tonight?"
Bob and Ken felt a bit uncomfortable, because they knew it was the hangman, and so they said they didn't know. They weren't very convincing. And Pascoe said,
"I bloody knows. That were the hangman."
Earlier in the day, a hospital officer weighed and measured Pascoe so Harry Allen, the hangman, could work out precisely how far he would drop. In his interview, Bob talks about the last visitor Pascoe had.
At about 10:30, the chief officer came in to inform us that Pascoe's brother had persuaded a friend to bring him to Bristol on the back of a motor scooter from their home in Cornwall. They'd broken down and been delayed, so under the circumstances, the chief allowed the visit, and so Pascoe had a last visit from a brother and a friend. Conversation was stilted and sad, the two lads weary from their long winter journey, and Pascoe with his mind full of what was going to happen in a few hours. After about 40 minutes, as conversation ran out, we stopped the visit and they said their melancholy goodbyes. Back in the cell, a sleeping potion had been left for Pascoe. He took it, but it didn't seem to work as he talked to us until about 2 a.m. before finally going to bed. Just before 7 a.m, we were relieved by two Bristol officers, the chief officer and a hospital officer. As I left the cell for the last time, I glanced at Pascoe, who was sound asleep. It made it easier for me. How do you say goodbye to someone when you know he will be dead in less than an hour?
Bob and Ken, the guards, had breakfast in the mess with Harry Allen and his assistant, and about 5 to 8, they watched as the local dignitaries, who were there to witness the execution, entered the block, followed by the two hangmen.
"Stand up, son,"
said Harry Allen to Russell Pascoe as he entered the condemned cell in Horfield Prison just before 8 a.m. on Tuesday, the 17th of December, 1963.
"Do as I say, and it will all be quick and easy."
Pascoe stood. Allen's assistant bound his arms behind his back. Then two prison officers took hold of him and led him quickly to a room straight across from the cell door. Pascoe was moved onto a trap door while the assistant bound his ankles with a leather strap. Harry Allen pulled a hood over his head, then a noose, tightening the rope, twisting the knot to the side of Pascoe's neck. Allen stepped backwards, signalling the two prison officers to do the same. He pulled a lever. The trapdoor opened and Pascoe fell, almost certainly dead a moment after jerking to a stop at the end of the rope. It had been just 14 seconds since Allen had asked him to stand. In the mess, having their breakfast, the two guards heard, on the fifth stroke, a loud whoomph as the padded doors of the trap opened and bounced off the walls below. It was over. In the prison, as the clock struck 8, in their cells, every inmate knew what that meant, and the prison erupted into a cacophony of noise. That chilly December morning in 1963 saw the few dozen people in the prison gates slowly disperse after the clock struck 8. Some left banners and placards, one of which had a Quaker tract on saying, "Let the law of kindness know no limits. Show a loving consideration for all God's creatures." Another, left propped against the prison gate, simply said, "Thou shalt not kill."
Do you love true crime but are looking for something different?
It sounds like a sitcom.
It does.
The Benders.
The kind of assholes you should probably leave them alone.
Do you like learning about cases so off the wall they can't possibly be true?
Her wig is enormous, but it is lifted off her head by a monkey.
Do you love history, but want to hear about what they didn't teach you in school? It's just got a "home is where you hang your horns" sign.
Do you like laughing awkwardly about cases that are bizarre and a little strange?
They'd be able to wield so many knives with all of their little arms.
Then we have the podcast for you. Join me, Lindsay.
And me, Madison, for Ye Olde Crime.
Where we discuss the funny, strange, and obscure crimes of yesteryear.
Listen every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And we'll see you next time with another tale
as old as crime.
In the news today, boffins in Bristol have discovered why skeletons can't play church music. It's because they don't have any organs.
Back in the day facts.
And so we start with the 4th of May, 1979, when Margaret Thatcher becomes the first woman to be elected Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. She was eventually forced to resign in 1990 after challenges to her leadership of the party by senior Conservatives. On the 5th of May, 1921, fashion designer Coco Chanel releases her first perfume, Chanel No. 5. May the 6th in 1966 sees the Rolling Stone release the single Paint It Black, which has the sitar played by Brian Jones. The 7th of May 1765 sees HMS Victory launch at Chatham Dockyard, a Royal Navy dockyard located on the River Medway in Kent. 40 years later, it would become Admiral Nelson's flagship at Trafalgar. On the 8th of May 1945, German General Wilhelm Keitel formally surrenders to the Allies, represented by the United States, UK, France and the Soviet Union in Berlin. The 9th of May, 1941, British intelligence at Bletchley Park breaks the German spy codes after capturing the Enigma machines aboard the weather ship Munchen. And lastly, on the 10th of May, 1915, Canadian physician Clooney McPherson first presents his gas mask invention to the British War Office. Well, that, my friends, is the end of another show. But don't worry, because I'll be here same time, same place, next week. And as always, let's thank those who brought today's show to life. And this week, we have our very own Steve Shepherd, as well as Molly Jeffries, Sam Roberts, Joe Wilson and Steve Yeo from St. Stephen's Drama Group right here in Bristol. Thank you, one and all. And for your information, one of our voice actors in this episode is Stephen Yeo, who is actually an accomplished author. And if you want to find out more about his books, you can go to his website, stephenjyeo.com. It's all one word, all lowercase, and the Yeo is spelled Y-E-O. Thank you once again for listening to me, Alice, on the Backtracker History Show. If you'd like to get in touch with me, you can find me on Twitter or Facebook by looking up at Backtracker UK with a capital B, a capital T, and a capital UK. I also occasionally post onto TikTok and Instagram. So do come along and find me, because it's amazing to hear from you and get some feedback or even ideas for future shows. As a small independent podcaster, your help and support is always appreciated. And one way you can do that is to rate the show wherever you get your podcasts. Leaving a review also helps, as it gives other people an idea of what the show's about. The show is regularly released on Mondays. So until next time, guys, take care and look after each other.